Hi, everybody. It's Sharon Hall, and I'm here today with Dr. Farah Daly. Dr. Daly is a neuropalliative physician, and she did a podcast with me back in 2020 when the first time I heard the word neuropalliative, and she explained it to us, and she recently was at the AFTD conference, but some people did have problems getting into her session, and her session, unfortunately, was not recorded, so we couldn't listen to it afterwards. So I asked Dr. Daly if she would come and help us understand what's updated since 2020 and tell us a little more about palliative care. So welcome, Dr. Daly.
Thank you. So fun to be back with you again.
Dr. Daly, can you explain the difference? This is a big deal for some people. Could you explain the difference between palliative care, neuropalliative care, and hospice, please? There's always so much confusion about it.
Right. And there are a lot of different ways to answer this question. And so I think probably the most straightforward thing is to approach it in a couple of different layers. So one layer would be how the different types of medical philosophies developed and how they grew from each other. And then another layer is the kind of the logistics now of how they differ from each other. So, those are the two layers I want to address it in. The first layer, in terms of how they developed, really, out of these, formal hospice care came first. And I like to think of hospice as like the proud mama that birthed the palliative care movement and then the neuropalliative care movement subsequently. So, hospice originated in it's as old as time. Care of the dying is as old as time, but the formal modern hospice movement really originated in the 1960s to 1970s when there was a shifting culture and attention to the dying period in around the world, really, particularly in England and the United States. But there were champions of care of the dying saying like, why, you know, we've developed treatments and cures for illnesses, and that's amazing, but we also need to care for the people that are not necessarily being cured. And so champions like Dame Cecily Saunders in England really developed a philosophy and approach that even in the dying period, there should be a diligent management of physical symptoms for people's comfort, that management should have a scientific approach and not be like an afterthought or a willy-nilly approach, but that there should actually be rigorous science behind the way people are treated, and a broadening attention to the whole family around a person's care. So not just the person who is living with an illness or dying from an illness, but also the family that is helping to care for them or surrounding them and the community within which they live. Incorporating a whole team approach. And so that was really the origins in hospice care, in care of the dying. And then, you know, it's not, it doesn't take a great leap of thought to realize that those things would be valuable, not just in the period of dying, but throughout the entire period of living for an illness. It's not, you know, you don't just get a family who's affected by your illness when you're in the dying period. They've been there the whole time. You don't just get physical symptoms in the dying period. Like, there are symptoms that interfere with quality of life the whole time that you're living with an illness. And the whole community around the community that you're living within and the resources and strengths or weaknesses of that community are affecting how you can thrive within your illness throughout the entire course of illness. So it's, you know, once this philosophy was developed with a focus on care of the dying, it was really obvious why people would want to expand that philosophy to care of people who are still, you know, dealing with and living with their illness. And that's really the origins of the palliative care movement. You know, with quotes by prominent and important people that, you know, that palliative care is about living well, palliative care is about living as well as you can for as long as you can. And neuropalliative care is really the application of this philosophy specifically within neurologic illness. Neurology is a perfect fit for palliative medicine because so many of our illnesses within neurology are ones that we manage over a lifetime or over a period of years, but that we are unable to cure. And many of our neurologic illnesses continue to progress and ultimately result in death. And so it is a natural fit for there to be a focus on quality of life and on the entire community of care throughout the course of care. Now, this is a bridge to the second layer of describing these services now, because the other thing to understand is now, logistically, how do these differ from each other? Now there's neuropalliative care, there's palliative care, and hospice care all in existence in our U.S. healthcare system. So hospice care is a system of care that involves a whole team approach that is only available to people who are thought to be within the last months of their life. And it affects the way care is paid for. So it's a covered benefit of Medicare. Once someone decides to add hospice care to their support network, then their insurance starts paying the hospice team for care, ideally so that the person living with illness and family don't have to worry about all the little things anymore because there's an organization taking care of it. And then the hospice becomes financially responsible for medicines and equipment and as well as the medical care. So that is hospice is a whole system of care that affects payment, and it's limited to people who are within the last months of their life. Now, I won't derail about how it's hard in neurologic disease to know when people are in the last months of their life. That's like a whole hour-long podcast in itself. But that's the logistics of hospice care. Now, palliative care is available to anyone regardless of the stage of their illness. There is value in palliative care from the time of diagnosis. In some illnesses that are hereditary, there's potentially value in palliative care, even when you're just generationally dealing with an illness and someone might not even know they have it yet. So it's the key distinction there is it's not limited based on a prognosis or a survival time. It's available to anyone, and it does not affect the way that care is paid for. A palliative physician or nurse practitioner, a palliative clinician is paid for in the same way that other clinicians of their type are paid for. So I, as a neuropalliative physician, when I see a person living with neurologic disease, I get paid by their insurance company via the same standards and the same mechanisms as when they see another specialist like a cardiologist or an internist or gastroenterologist. And the way that their medicines are paid for, the way that they get equipment, they're still in the same normal system that they're used to being in. I guess now actually there's a third layer. I'm going to add a third layer to my layers of distinguishing between these, because I think this is a useful construct to help people understand the way that palliative care is different from typical care or typical illness-focused care, and subsequently the way that neuropalliative care differs from typical or traditional neurologic care. One is that with regard to treatments, in palliative care or neuropalliative care, the focus is on improving quality of life in the current time period and recognizing that decline is expected over time. Whereas the typical model is focused on basically living longer, cure when possible, living longer as a second priority and quality symptom management as a third priority historically. This is an evolution, but this is a distinction between palliative care and typical care or traditional care. The other main difference is that in traditional care, there tends to be complete focus on the person who is ill, which means like all the conversations are happening with that person. Other people might feel the rest of the family who's involved in the care can feel ostracized or specifically left out from conversations. And in dementia, as someone is progressing with dementia, this is a particular problem because the time period when someone's able to handle and process the information on their own is kind of fuzzy. Like it sneaks up on you. So a lot of families have gone through a period where they haven't been being included in conversations. And then once it's obvious that they need to be included in conversations, there's a gap in time and a gap in information that everybody's trying to figure out and make up for. So a difference there is that within the palliative approach or the neuropalliative approach, the family and the community involved in care are kind of actively engaged from the beginning. So, you know, it's very rare when I'm working with someone in an early stage of an illness, my visits are almost universally with all the family members that are involved. It's very rare that I would
do that. Do you do that by teleconference or do you do that with bring the whole group in, or how is that handled when you are working with a whole family?
Yeah, it varies based on what the needs are in an individualized approach. So most commonly I'm working with some sort of dyad, whether it's a person living with illness and their spouse or partner, or a person living with illness and their adult child, or a child living with illness and their parent. Most often I'm working with a dyad in person. And then part of my initial assessment is figuring out what other, to use a business term, like what other stakeholders are involved, like who else has an interest and an influence in what is going on. And from there, we figure out who else needs to be involved. So, and then we might do that by, you know, depending on where they are, by teleconference. You know, a lot of times I'm working with a married or longtime partner dyad, but a child living some distance away has a lot of influence on the situation as well as responsibility for the situation in the event that something went awry. Right. And so I'll make a suggestion to get that person involved. And then, you know, we either do it in person or over video, whatever needs to be done, frankly.
And, you know, what I find in palliative and why I tell people to ask for it immediately upon diagnosis is that oftentimes when we're at even a neurologist or our primary care, our time is so limited with them. And with palliative care, you feel more involved and less likely to hesitate calling for advice to this neurologist or primary care physician, because heaven knows when they'll get back to you and they're going to give you like 2.5 seconds. So do you think that's also something in palliative care that is really important? The fact that you may spend more time with a family and understanding the whole process, that seems to me like a huge benefit in palliative care.
It's definitely a difference. I think it's interesting to try to think about and examine the reasons for that difference and how that has implications down the road for the way that palliative programs can be sustainable in our current healthcare environment, or the way that they might be able to be funded. Because there's so many different factors, but a lot of medicine is a situation where the revenues are based on the volume of people that are seen. And so So big healthcare systems are under a lot of pressure, and the clinicians working within those systems are under a lot of pressure to see people quickly and move on to the next thing. So that's one element that makes time with clinicians very short. Whereas, you know, I think people who are focused on palliative care, first of all, you just go into it knowing that these are not issues that you can unpack in 15 minutes. You know, in 15 minutes, knowing someone new, they're barely going to share anything with you, let alone starting to uncover like what is the source of stress that they, or, you know, or the thing that they worry about when they fall asleep at night. It's, we can work, you know, for years and years to try to figure out like the best question to ask to understand that. But without putting in time in developing and exploring the relationship, people are not going to volunteer that information. I mean, it's rare that someone's going to volunteer those deepest, darkest worries. So there's one element. I think people in palliative care just know it takes time to unpack these issues. And so visits tend to be longer. This is, you know, on the whole, the way that makes palliative care work in a larger healthcare setting is that, this is how people spin it anyway, is that people unpacking all these issues and putting in the time maybe doesn't create revenue based on volume of seeing people quickly, but you do a good thing for the person living with illness by explaining treatments and conditions and unpacking the worries so that people can their efforts more appropriately and not be kind of like wasting their own time and money on pursuing things that are not going to actually serve their goals and values. And then that also kind of subsequently supposedly translates into savings for the healthcare system. Now, I have to say, well, there's a couple things I would want to say about this. And one is that there's another reason besides just like the like evil money man situation to try to get a lot of people through it, you know, an academic neurology center quickly. And another one is that there's not necessarily enough people with expertise, say in FTD. You know, there's not that many people across the country with expertise in FTD and new research and new developing treatments, which are very important. And so if you want to serve as many as people as possible, I don't blame those people necessarily for trying to get through a lot of patients quickly, because there's an element of just, you know, wanting to meet everybody's needs and serving
as many people as possible. Absolutely. I understand that totally. Yeah.
But I think that's why it takes more than one person. Like somebody might think, well, like, why do I need to have a neurologist who I see who's an FTD specialist and then also have a neuropalliative specialist? Like, why would I need two neurologists? Shouldn't they both be able to do everything? And actually, I think every neurologist should have better primary palliative skills, better ability to kind of like sense when there's an emotional need and direct it in the right way, and so on. But I don't think all these things can be done by one person in one visit. I think it takes time and it needs to be spread out they need some space from each other to both be very functional. And I think they both serve a role.
Yes, I agree totally. I've encouraged Emory to put a palliative team in their neurology clinic. Mm-hmm. Simply because they need to pump out diagnosis. Let's face it. That's their job, is to get people diagnosed correctly, especially with dementia and particularly FTD. I want neurologists to be diagnosing more people that need to be diagnosed. And, mm-hmm. and I sort of see palliative sometimes as the bridge between, it's sort of a medical bridge between the, especially neuropalliative, between the neurologist and a counselor or a psychology kind of, it's really kind of that bridge, you know, because a person that you would go to with these worries, might be a counselor of some type, but they're not connected to that medical side. So to me, it seems like a neuropalliative particularly is sort of that bridge, you know, between the neurologist and the and getting your personal care of the crisis you might be in. If you have, you know what I'm talking about here? Yeah.
Yeah, I think I agree with that completely. And I think that, you know, it's natural then for there to be some overlap in the skills of the different people that are involved in care. So, you know, there's maybe some overlap in skill between a diagnosis focused neurologist and me as a palliative neurologist, but I can't do everything that they do. And they can't do everything that I do. There's a little bit of overlap that maybe, you know, we could each do. And similarly, if someone is working with a counselor, there's an overlap in what I can provide and what they can provide. But it's not completely the same. And so I think that's some of the tensions that need to be resolved or maybe just accepted in our healthcare system is that the payment system and the regulatory system tries to like demand just enough staff to do like just every job. And I think that's not really functionally how it works. There needs to be a little bit of overlap and a little bit of redundancy to make the care actually seamless. And
because you do need some overlap. I mean, that's the whole thing about being a care manager kind of thing, you know, for everybody to talk about this person as a whole,
right?
The person is a whole person. And a lot of times when you have these, you know, we've talked about silos before, you and I, and that silo thing where the neurologist doesn't talk to the counselor and the counselor doesn't talk to the neurologist, it doesn't make sense. It makes much more sense if you're serving the patient. You need to talk to everyone that's involved with the patient.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, I hope that it gets there at some point and we stop the siloing of everything. Let me ask you this. What do you think neuropalliative can offer a family that makes their journey easier? What is a primary thing that you can point out to say, when you get palliative care, this is what you're going to get as a family that you may not get anywhere else?
I think that that's a great question. And I think that, I mean, there's, you know, obviously, as we've been talking about already, there's numerous different things that a neuropalliative specialist might do. They might be focusing on physical symptoms. They might be focusing on family and carer support. They might be focusing on planning for the future. And really, when I do an assessment, part of what I'm not just checking boxes. You know, I'm kind of assessing each of these different domains and then focusing my influence on where a person's individual needs are. That said, the one thing I think that you probably that is hard to get anywhere else is really the anticipatory guidance of understanding where you are right now in the context of an illness and knowing what both the kind of like the next immediate phases are to be prepared for. And then also, you know, how is your current situation set up to be sustainable as you get into later stages? I think that's that kind of guidance for both the near term and the long term future is something that you don't necessarily get anywhere else. And that is because it's as you said, that's where you need the medical, like a medical bridge. Like there are people that help with care planning. But if you don't put it in the context of the illness and the stages of the illness, then there's a gap and there's a piece missing. And so I think that's probably the thing that you really may struggle to get anywhere else is the anticipatory guidance.
And that's very, very important, especially with FTD. I mean, you know, that, and a, for care partners, you know, anticipatory grief is just so primary in our minds all the time as we see these people slipping further away from us, and every day something new might pop up. Mm-hmm. The fact that you involve the family and you're involved with that caregiver, you can sort of help that anticipatory, because oftentimes people I see on Facebook all the time where people say, oh, my husband or my wife is doing this, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that gap, you're absolutely right. There's no one to fill that gap, but a palliative team. And they're the ones that can say this, what is what you might see next. So I think that's very, very valuable. What's the best way to find a palliative or a neuropalliative care? Where do you go first?
Oh, that's a huge question. And you know, it's a huge question, because there's probably not one right answer right now. And that is because neuropalliative care in particular is a new and developing field, or relatively new and developing field. The good news is it's developing like, I'm trying to think of a good analogy that's like positive. It's like developing like, you know, like a train. The train has been like chugging, leaving the station, and now it's like really picking up speed, and is getting bigger and bigger and picking up more speed over time. So every week I'm getting, you know, calls from people who are in training as neurologists who are more interested in palliative care, or who want to spend some time seeing what neuropalliative is like. So hopefully, you know, in another, well, it's been 2 years since our last conversation, and in another 2 years, it would be a different answer with a real one clear place to look for. Right now, I'd say that both palliative care and neuropalliative care have variable availability across the country. Neuropalliative care in particular is still, there are a couple of centers of neuropalliative care, and there are some individuals out there like me, but it's still very spotty, you know, even more so. There's probably not enough words to describe like how small it is, except I guess I could say that there's just about 160 neurologists that are board certified in palliative medicine in the entire country.
Yeah,
that's a tiny, tiny number.
Exactly.
But one place that's always a good place to start, even though, as you and I have talked about before, you don't always get a satisfactory answer, but I'm a big believer in like asking the same question of a lot of different people until you get the answer that you need, and don't settle for your first no. So I think a good place to start is always with the primary care clinician. Ideally, if that's an invested and involved person, they're going to know about local resources, and they might be able to direct you to a strong local palliative care service or to a neuropalliative care service. Now, again, as you and I have talked about, even in the medical field, people need more education and knowledge about palliative care and neuropalliative care and where they fit in. So it's possible that you'd find somebody who says, you know, that it's not appropriate for you, or that they're not aware of resources. But then you're going to keep going and taking next steps. So another resource that's growing and developing is the International Neuropalliative Care Society, which was just hot off the press when we spoke in October 2020, and is really growing and developing now. There is a website now, and there are plans for the future to make more information available just on the public side of that page, for being able to find a neuropalliative specialist. But there is a like contact us for information button. And we do get some queries via that button, which basically just sends an email to the administration of the organization, and they try to route it around to the right person. So that's another resource to keep checking in on. And it's a resource that I expect to get more and more robust over time.
And give us that website.
That is www.inpcs.org. So International Neuro Palliative Care Society, INPCS.org.
Yes, and please go there. Yeah. Dr. Daly has gotten me involved in the INPCS, and you can be involved too and help promote neuropalliatives throughout the country. So please go to that website and visit it. And they have a lot of information there, and you'll see some information about neuropalliative and how you can help progress that whole area, because we really need that.
And it really is developing more and more, you know, so...
Yeah, let's understand that it didn't come around. It didn't even start until January of 2021. So that was kind of the beginning of it. So we're just getting into this society. So those of us that want neuropalliative care in our area, it behooves us to become involved in the society to try to help promote that. Because, you know, people will get you what you scream about. And you scream enough about the fact that you want neuropalliative care in your area, and people will start listening. So,
yeah. And on that note, it's very helpful for INPCS if, you know, if someone goes to the website looking for a particular thing, but they don't find it there, it's super helpful to the organization to hit the button to send a query and say, you know, I came to your website looking for this, but I didn't find it. Like, that might be something that will help us know what to develop next or what needs to target. I think, like, you know, scream in every way and in every direction you can, including to us.
Yes, that's right. Because you don't get what you don't ask for.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes in a hospital setting, palliative care is called a different thing, and sometimes it's confusing. Even the palliative team doesn't know that they're the palliative team.
Yeah.
And if we have some, let's say we have the ideal situation. We have a palliative team in place, hopefully a neuropalliative team in place, but now we have pneumonia and we're in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Should we at that point just rely on our palliative team to help direct us through things, or should we ask for that hospital palliative team to also be involved? How does that work?
I think it's always a good idea to, if you're in a crisis situation like that, which a hospitalization is generally some kind of crisis, then, I do recommend that people ask for the hospital-based palliative team. I think that what's important to keep in mind, and the other thing that I try to empower people that I'm working with, you know, patients and families, I want them to feel empowered to assess the interest and skill of that palliative team. Because there are some places where the palliative team is not necessarily as skilled as we would like. They're maybe they are serving more as a function of outreach for whatever end of life program is in place, and not necessarily the kind of rigorous scientific and invested neuropalliative service that we think everybody should deserve. So I think it's important to ask, like I would, yes, ask for the palliative care team to be involved. And then, you know, and then feel free to, I guess, you know, dismiss them if you're not getting what you're used to or what you know to expect from palliative care. Like, you as empowered people living with an illness, you know to expect like diligent, thoughtful symptom management, with an exploration of your own goals and values, and seeing how things fit in. And so if you're not hearing that from the people that come to see you, then you know they're not what you need. So you know, if you do have that good scenario where you've already been working with palliative care, you know, prior to this illness, neuropalliative care or palliative care, then you're also going to want to reach out to the person who knows you well and has been following. And ideally, they're going to liaison. I mean, that happens for me here in Northern Virginia, where I might be working with someone who gets hospitalized. And when they're working with palliative care in the hospital, it's a small world. Like I know who those people, I know who those people are. And I can help to provide some direction for the conversation to make it more useful for everyone. Because as we talked about, palliative care takes a lot of time. It's not someone meeting you in the hospital for the first time is going to do their best to explore goals and values, but they're not going to have the benefit of a long relationship where they've really uncovered layers of things over time. And so, you know, in the perfect scenario, you're working with somebody from palliative for a long time. It's a small world, and they're going to also know the person in the hospital, and together you get your needs met. I always want people to think about getting services from the perspective of their own needs. So especially right now when services are variable, rather than kind of pigeonholing themselves and saying, you know, I need neuropalliative care and there's not neuropalliative care in my area. So, you know, oh, well, I'm just out of luck and this is the bad way that I have to live. And then kind of call it a day. You know, advocate for there to be neuropalliative care in your area. Don't give up on that. But instead of saying like, I need neuropalliative care or else, I'd say like, what are my needs? Well, I'm living with an illness. I need to have my symptoms managed. I need to have my adjustment, my emotional adjustment to this illness addressed. I need to understand where I sit in the context of the illness right now and what's going to happen next. And I need to know that my plan's sustainable for the long-term future. Like these are my needs. So which one's primary right now? And then fill that need based on the services that are available around you. And it varies, you know, if you happen to live near the neuropalliative group that's at the University of Colorado in Denver, then you might be having like great outpatient based specialist neuropalliative care throughout your illness, which is awesome and amazing. But when you're thinking about, you know, maybe when you're living there, when you're thinking about next steps, if you're thinking about like the possibility of a different care setting or the possibility of utilizing an assisted living or long-term care facility, maybe that outpatient group is not actually going to have the knowledge base there and you might have to pull in another person. You know, versus if you live here in Northern Virginia near me, the people that I work with, they often have a study-based neurologist who is like doing clinical trials in an academic center. And then they might have a neurologist who kind of handles day-to-day medications that don't have to travel so far to see. Then they have the third neurologist, me, who's being the medical bridge to the rest of the interdisciplinary team. And so the structure of the neurologists is different, but when that person needs help figuring out the care situation at home, or they need to think about the long-term care facilities in their area, potentially, I know all those things because I go into all those long-term care facilities. That's where my practice is. So all this to say, the structure of how you meet your needs is going to be different based on where you live. So rather than say like, well, I need a neuropalliative person and a neurologist, and then my job is done, I'd say think about what your needs are and then fill the needs with the services that are available in your area. Does that make sense? I wish I could make it more specific for people.
You know, a lot of times people will say they'll live in, you know, the middle of nowhere in the country kind of thing, and they don't have a palliative team even available to them. What would be the place that they would go to ask about their needs? Would it be their primary physician, or should they call a hospice and say, who can meet these needs for me? What do you do if you can't find a palliative team?
Yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, I'm trying to answer this on the fly, thinking about it, because I have the privilege of living in an area where resources in general are pretty robust. You know, right. Northern Virginia, there's there are a lot of resources. But I think that it is a scenario where it goes back to that concept of asking a lot of people the question, knowing and not kind of giving up with the first no, that you might have to keep asking.
Yeah. So now let me just, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I always say to people as well that 99% of hospitals with 300 beds or more have a palliative team. I mean, that's what CAPC says, right? Mm-hmm. So can we go to that? And do you think they can at least guide a person who's not in the hospital to someone who could meet those needs? Is that a good route to go or not?
I think that should be one of the, if you were going to kind of keep a short list of places to go and ask, I would always start with the primary care clinician. I would start with that person. I think inquiring at the local hospital to contact someone in palliative care at the hospital is also on the short list. Contacting a local hospice would be also on the short list. And then I would say going to your internet resources of like getpalliativecare.org and impcs.org to go there to, I think that would be my short list of places to seek resources. And a lot of times people are going to be, if people really are living in an area where the resources aren't there, then that is a huge value of the internet-based support groups and things like what you do, Sharon, because you're in tune. I mean, you're providing palliative care for a lot of people in the work that you do in your support group.
Wow.
You might not have known that, you know, but you're, you know, when you're working with
the pay people, in this area is very poor.
Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of comfort from them as well.
This is why I think it's, this is why I think it's so critical for people to be flexible in the way that they're meeting their needs and to start to be able to almost develop their own personal palliative approach. People can develop don't get me wrong. I want everyone to have a neuropalliative multidisciplinary team available them at a moment's notice.
But that's not going to be everywhere. And we know it might take a very long time for it to be there.
Right.
So in the interim, you know, and I agree with you, you know, I jokingly say, the pay is poor, but honest, that's why we tell people to always get into a support group. You know, because they can connect you with people that know people that know people, right? In their local area, or like my chat that's on Mondays and Saturdays, that is across the country, sometimes across the world, believe it or not. And at least we can help you with symptom management as well. So, you know, we are sort of palliative. You're right. There are a lot of things that we talk about in our chat that are very palliative. So I think if you're in an area that's sort of a desert for palliative care, it's really important for you to connect with, like in this realm, in the FTD community, to connect with other FTD people, you know, other FTD families, because they can give you a lot of information about, especially when you have a larger group, like my group on Mondays and Saturdays, you know, they're across the country. So a lot of times there'll be somebody in your neighborhood and they also have been there, done that. So my group, I have people from, they just got diagnosed 2 weeks ago, to people who have lost their person and stay involved to help other people not make the same mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're right. That is palliative.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's important for people to also understand that they need that disease-specific support group.
Yes, for sure. I mean,
very, very important.
There's so much. Oh, sorry. I was just going to say there's so much that's unique. There's so much that's unique about FTD and that can easily get glossed over, disregarded in less specific groups. That You know, their FTD is one of a handful of illnesses where it's, there are really unique challenges.
Yes, there are. And those of us that are in the community sometimes get, I mean, we even can give you very practical information about what's the best nighttime incontinence product.
Yeah.
You know? And those are things that, you know, people just don't know where to go for that. And actually I probably should mention the chat because I only posted in Facebook. If you're part of the Facebook groups on about FTD, there's an AFTD site, there's the frontotemporal degeneration info and support group. And if you're a spouse, there's the FTD spouse group on Facebook. And those are very good for you to join. I do post my chat there, but I keep it the same. The login is always the same. It's get a pen, get ready in case you never heard of me before. The chat is, you log in, it's Zoom. And the Zoom ID is 706-9740831. And the password is lowercase FTD chat. And we meet every Monday and Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern time. So I usually don't do a plug like that, but I think now that we're talking, maybe there are people that listen to the podcast that don't even know that I have a chat. So maybe I should talk about Silo, right?
Yeah, for sure, right? And we didn't plan that. That's, you know, but I think that this is part of the thing that's not unique, but that's special about a palliative approach and a palliative approach within medicine is the recognition of the value of all of the different ways that people get their care, and to have a broader look at what care is. And so sometimes people are getting their anticipatory guidance and their emotional adjustment needs met by working with the support group. And, you know, me being a medical bridge involved in these things, I learn from that back and forth interaction too. Like, what is the best, you know, what is the best incontinence pad to use for night? Like, that's a question that I will get in a home visit with a patient.
Want me to tell you what it is?
Yeah, no, not necessarily. I don't know what kind of arrangements you have for your, maybe you can get a sponsorship out of this. I mean,
there is one product that beats all the rest, but we'll leave that for another time.
Yeah.
Let me just ask you this question. What do you find with families who have dementia, particularly FTD in the home? Because I do know you see people with FTD. What's been their most requested need for help? What is it that they in the FTD community come to you and say, this is a need that's not getting met for me?
I'm gonna answer this in sort of three different phases of illness. So, because I think the questions that come to me vary based on the phase of illness that people are in. So, even though I would like to be involved with people from the time of diagnosis onward, there's still a tendency for people either to not know about palliative care or not hear about it or not be referred until later. So it's, a lot of the people that I work with, the majority of my practice are people in later stage illness. And I would say the things that those families are asking about, the most common question from those families is that they're seeing decline. And is it medicines or is it the illness? That I think is the most common question that comes to me in late stage illness. Like there's decline, has something gone wrong in the medical plan of care, and that maybe the medicines, people are always reasonably concerned that medicines are contributing to decline. So that's the most common question that I try to sort out there. I would also say for late stage illness, a really close second issue that I get called for is when people find them that they've been hitting a wall. So they keep having problems, but they keep like seeking help, but not getting help. And it's, but not necessarily in a clear way. So like things, there's like a symptom change at home, and they go off to the emergency room, and then the emergency room's like, "Meh, I can't find anything." And they're back home again, but things aren't better. So they're still dealing with the same problems. Or they see their neurologist or primary care physician, and it's kind of the same thing. Like, the care that they seek is care that addresses only a little part. Like they address like diagnosis and kind of curing of superimposed illnesses. And if they don't find anything there, then they send you back off with no intervention. And so that's another call I get when people have just been hitting a wall, and maybe they've been in the ER several times, or they've been back and forth to the doctor several times. And usually the problem that I uncover there is, you know, it's something related to caregiving at home that needs to be addressed, that's invisible to people in typical care, outpatient care environments. Or it might be unrecognized disease progression, or kind of just a mismatch between the care that's happening and the phase the person's in. In middle stage illness, the most common issue by far is to help with behavior management. So people are trying to keep their lives livable. They're trying to enjoy things, and there are behavioral symptoms that are either interfering with those activities or are interfering with people getting quality rest. And so in those are situations that I really enjoy, because a lot of times I really can adjust medications in a way that makes things better for everybody, so that there's more time to enjoy quality of life activities. Early stage illness, I have to say that still, even though in theory we would always say that palliative care has value from diagnosis onward, it's not so often we get to put that in practice, just because it's not asked for that often, or it's just not available when people are in early stage illness. So that is a scenario where I'm learning a lot from the people that are asking for me and the people that I'm working with. I'd say the most common question there right now, because people that ask to be involved with me in early stage illness are naturally very proactive, planning type people. So they're usually people that already have a pretty robust plan in mind, and they're looking for my assessment or reassurance to see that there's no gaps in that care. And we do, you know, find some gaps here or there. Or I think the part that I really add is the anticipatory guidance of knowing what problems people run into couple phases down the road, and being able to spot, you know, with a little tweak, maybe you can avert that problem from 4 steps down the road. Like it's not close, but if you adjust something now, then maybe you're not going to be in a situation of major burnout, several years from now.
Right.
So because it's more often that I'm meeting people who have hit that wall or who are in that crisis, and then we're trying to back up and fix it. But when I have the opportunity to work with someone in early stage illness, I can anticipate some of those problems and hopefully keep them from ever hitting a wall, like I'm usually getting called for in late stage illness. Even simple things like, well, I review people's advanced care planning documents, and I might say like, oh, you know, I see something here that could turn into a problem for you down the road. And it, you know, simple things like, we named our 2 children as the next decision maker in the event that something happens to the first decision maker. And I might find out like, oh, and those children live on opposite sides of the country and they don't get along very well. You know, like, oh, I just will call that to people's attention as that might not be, you know, that's a setup for a future crisis. And sometimes I'm involved with people in that later crisis where you're trying to get family members who naturally have different communication styles and, you know, don't have an easy relationship, now trying to handle a crisis situation of medical decision making jointly is, you know, that's definitely a situation to avoid. And so, like, I might find little things like that, bring it to people's attention. It's their choice if they want to do anything about it or take action on the things that I spot. But I like to think that I can help. You know, there's a whole bunch of ways for a crisis to arise, but some of them are pretty predictable. And, you know, you can take simple steps to avoid them.
Well, this has just been a fabulous conversation. You know, I could talk to you all day about this, and but I think we've brought out quite a few things that people need to focus on. And like I always say, get palliative care from diagnosis, because as Dr. Daly is saying, she can help you avoid those future pitfalls. So it's very important. I do know that she has some FTD people that were early in diagnosis that she services. And so, you know, come to the chat. We'll do your palliative care for how do I handle when he yells at somebody in public?
Right.
We'll help you with that. And certainly if you're in the Northern Virginia area, please reach out to Dr. Farah Daly at Even Beam Neuropalliative Care. And she, as you can hear, is just a wonderful, wonderful person to walk you through this very difficult journey. So Dr. Daly, thank you so much for joining me again. And maybe we shouldn't wait 2 years till we do it again, right?
Right. I think so. I think the train will run off and there will be just too much ground for us to cover.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's getting there, right? So thank you again very much for your time. And thank you all for listening. I hope you've gotten something out of this. And let us know if there are other subjects you'd like Dr. Daly to address. And we'll do special podcasts with her just on a topic.
Sounds
so
great.
I'm sure she'd be willing to do that. She's just a wonderful person. So thank you for attending, and we will put this up and you'll have it available to you forever. So thank you very much, Dr. Daly.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.